Blog Talk Radio.
I can't remember anything that happened before 2 weeks ago.
I'm Michael Lawson, along with Thomas Fortenberry, and we are here at the Hangout.
The Batcave.
The Batcave.
It has been a busy week, Mike.
Did you hear the beginning? Let me play this one more time. The beginning of this song.
I can't remember anything that happened before 2 weeks ago.
I can't remember anything.
Can't remember anything before 2 weeks ago?
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's play something that matches that.
Okay.
When the president had an opportunity to capture or kill Osama bin Laden, he took his focus off of him, outsourced the job to Afghan warlords, and Osama bin Laden escaped. 6 months after he said Osama bin Laden must be caught dead or alive, this president was asked, "Where's Osama bin Laden?" He said, "I don't know. I don't really think about him very much. I'm not that concerned." We need a president who stays deadly focused on the real war on terror.
Mr. President.
I don't think I ever said I'm not worried about Osama bin Laden. It's kind of one of those exaggerations.
So I don't know where he is. Nor do I, you know, I just don't spend that much time on him. I repeat what I said. I truly am not that concerned about him.
No.
He can't remember anything.
There's a guy that says, I don't think I ever said that. I mean, it's exaggeration, but I'll stand by my words. I don't care. I don't think about it. Yeah, he just repeats himself. But again.
But that's not the main thing. That is not the thing that Dick Cheney said. That's not what Dick Cheney said. That's not what Dick Cheney said at all.
Look.
He said, well, we've always been looking for him.
Oh, yeah.
We've been looking for him. When he was interviewed, let's see, it was just a few weeks after they killed Osama bin Laden. He says, oh, yeah, well, so we were looking for him. We were looking for him. We've been looking for him. Well, we never gave up on him.
Right.
So, but you see, we're going to get into more. We're going to get into this deeply.
Well, don't.
About who knows who's on first, who's on second, and I don't know, third base.
And then there's always the, it's hard to play against the baseball team when, you know, they all are in your daddy's company.
As a matter of fact, I should have had that clip of Abby Costello. Who's on first? What's on second? I don't know. Is third base? And who's pitching? No, who's not pitching? Who's on first? See, the thing is that they played musical chairs. Every time they asked one what the other one was doing, the other one say, who's on first? He said, no. Because, no, he's center field. See, the problem is that Dick Cheney was actually the president of the United States. Was actually the president of the United States. Dick Cheney put in place not just people, and I don't know if we're going to have a chance to get into it because it is so much, and we got some great guests today. We're going to have the great newspaper correspondent and columnist for the military affairs consultant for Knight Rider newspapers, Joe Galloway, on today discussing the wars. I mean, all the wars. We're going to have his charming wife on, Dr. Grace Lean Galloway, who's also chair of the Travis County Democratic Party. And I hope we are able to get Matt Newton, lawyer here in Shaw, who's up in arms about the police review board, and he should be because there isn't any. I mean, well, it's like, if they say you did it, you did it.
There's so much I could spend an entire month talking about the Bush, Cheney, Osama bin Laden war connections.
Well, if you remember when he...
But we could dive endlessly into that.
Oh,
it's,
please.
It's horrific.
It's, well, listen to this.
The people who knocked these buildings down will hit all of us soon.
Well, I didn't have it. No wonder I didn't hear anything because it wasn't
Michael,
in my earpiece.
Michael.
Yeah, I know. Well, this
you
is
had one of those days,
like,
Mike.
Yeah, well. Yeah, I didn't have the,
that's
the plug in
when
again.
It out. Okay. Listen, we've got connections on it. This is the thing that drives me nuts about it. Like the we took our eye off the ball. We didn't find him. You know, all of these later type things when they've been long running, and I mean decades long running business partners. And family, friends, and connections. I mean, the Bush family, the Bin Laden family, people don't realize they've been in business for decades. They know exactly where to find these people, which is exactly why, right after 9/11, if you remember, they put a no-fly, no restriction on the United States of America, except for members of the Bin Laden family. They were flown out, taxpayer expense, out of the country, from all over the place. You know, we got rid of all of those pesky little connections to the Bushes. But, look, these guys are going back. People forget. you remember under the Reagan-Bush years, we had that collapse of the banking system? You know, yet again, that's what they do all the time. But over there in Europe, all the banking institutions went down.
Mm-hmm.
Savings and loans over here, the scandals there. But over in Europe, there was a big, big, huge banking crisis. BCCI, remember that thing?
BCCI.
Bank of Credit and Commerce International.
Mm-hmm.
Well, to begin with, you know, people just have the short-term memory because, you know, you believe what you're told. But BCCI, you remember, was a front. It was a dirty offshore banking front for the CIA. And under the Reagan administration, they used it. That's where we remember this little thing called the Iran-Contra, you know, affair. We used to sell drugs and then sell weapons and equipment to Iran and to Iraq through intermediaries and hidden shell companies like BCCI. That's what we did. That's how we financed these little people you may have heard of, like Osama bin Laden. You remember, we created him in Al-Qaeda to fight the Soviets in Afghanistan.
Right.
And then there was another little guy that we funded, and we gave...
What's his name? Let me see. It's tricky, right?
It was sad.
It's
kind of sad, his name.
Yeah.
Saddam.
Saddam Hussein.
Yeah, you might have heard
S-A.
That guy, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the cause of a later war.
You run a little
country
over there? Right.
But see, this is where we, you know, the fact that, like, later Cheney and them come up with, we know they've got weapons of mass destruction and they've got chemical weapons and they've got all these horrible things and there's going to be mushroom clouds. It's because we sold them to them and they'd used them in Iran. If you remember, there was this little thing called the Iran-Iraq
War. That's how they got them.
Yes. But here's the thing. We funneled all of that to them through BCCI. It was the largest partner in that, by the way, was the Bush family and the bin Ladens. The bin Ladens, you know, are billionaires in Saudi Arabia. And they used, if you remember, this little fact came out when we went to war in the Gulf War.
Little fact?
Yeah. We go over there. You remember Cheney awards no bid contracts to himself. You remember that the KBR and all this, they get all the, you know, after we blow stuff up, let's
so this
give
was
this to
what
them.
Chase said.
I'm sorry, all I heard was Darth Vader. What was that?
Yeah. We will be received as liberators when we get over
yes,
there.
Yes. We will liberate that country for our oil interests and take care of all of their supplies.
Right.
They have a surplus of it. You know, But, you know, these guys were all in business together. They've been in business since the 70s. For instance, the BCCI, the banking, you know, front, that was the one, that was the banking industry that bailed out the Bush oil concerns. You remember this fact that Bush is, then this is W now, W was given an oil company that his father created, you know, because it was a CIA front, but given an oil company, and he was the only guy in Texas who could go bankrupt with an oil company. I mean, literally. You remember that? Well, to avoid the bankruptcy destroying him like it would a normal person.
A normal person, right.
He was bailed out by, guess who? The Bin Laden family in BCCI.
Yeah, but you see, now you're saying now, but wasn't it
but
that
so,
the Bin Laden family who was not really Bin Laden that we know?
Well, no, one of the sons, the father was in business with George Bush, the original George Bush, George H.W. Bush. They're in business together. They ran many companies together. If you remember, even during the Gulf War, it came out they were still in business together.
Mm-hmm.
While we were searching for Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan, he was still in business with him, and so he had to divest himself of those because it was embarrassing when it came out that, you know, these two billionaires ran a company together. And everything that we blew up over there, by the way, we gave the Arab construction contracts to rebuild all the roads and bridges that we bombed. You remember all that going into Baghdad, blowing up everything? Well, all of those contracts we gave to the, guess what, the Bin Laden Construction Group. Oh, I've never heard that name before. What's
the Bin Laden?
Right. So that's Osama's dad. And Osama's the rogue son. You know, I remember another rogue son. Is it W or was it Neil?
Well,
I never keep up with him.
Well,
but
let's not
compare and contrast.
Compare and contrast.
But so when I hear things like, we have no idea who did it, where to find him, and oh my goodness, he's gotten away, I'm more than skeptical.
Well, you have some news headlines that I think we need to get to. You need to get to.
I'm sorry. Which news headlines might
be? Well,
it's
the news headline should be there somewhere. I mean,
oh my goodness, there's so many news
on the second page. I think.
Is that the
that's
news
it?
Roundup?
That's it. Yeah, and then you got some stuff to
what we'll talk about.
Yeah.
So we're going. Besides talking about Cheney, and you know, he's just a favorite topic of mine because I think he's one of the most powerful yet maybe least understood and certainly least prosecuted guys.
Mine didn't come out yet.
It didn't come out. So instead of just talking about all Dick Cheney, I mean, this guy is fascinating. It's like literally the, you know, let's do a biography Darth Vader. He's an interesting guy.
But first of all, here's the thing. I want you to understand today, if you know it or not, is a major anniversary.
Yeah, I was trying to read that.
It's a major anniversary. Does anybody out there know
what super secret anniversary?
What
is?
The anniversary is? Mm-hmm. On March? Well, it's not today. It was March 26th, actually.
Okay. Well,
March 26th, mm-hmm. 50 years ago.
Okay.
Dick Cheney, first deferment.
Woo, happy deferment day.
Got his first deferment.
But you know what I say? I mean, congratulations, Dick, but what I like about Dick. He never gives up. He doesn't quit. You know, he doesn't take no for an answer. So what did he do? Why stop at one deferment, Mike? You've successfully gotten one. Hey, let's go for a few more. So how many deferments did he get?
Four
deferments?
Without even trying. Oh,
and for those who don't understand, you know, those born, after 1980 or some, all of our young listeners, we're talking about a little thing called the Vietnam War.
What was the name of that again?
Vietnam. This is a little country in Southeast Asia. You might want to look up on a map. I think they're a trading partner nowadays. But back in those days, we had problems with Vietnam and communism. There's something about that. I don't know.
We're going to have Joe Galloway on the phone. We need to talk to him about that.
Okay, because it's important. You know, back then we had a little thing called a draft, and it was
Is that the one that got me?
I think that was the one that got
me. But you know, I fooled him though. I fooled him.
Okay.
See, my grandpa was a major in the Army. He said, this is great. You go in there. I know a lot of people. You go to OCS. I said, are you kidding me? I'm not going in there.
I don't want the easy ride.
I'm in school. I'm in college. Just like Dick Cheney.
Yeah.
And he said, who's Dick Cheney?
Right.
Well, I understand 50 years from now, he's going to be famous.
Mm.
See, I had this foresight.
Yeah, and you also had this one little other problem against you.
Yes.
That little box on the corner that probably said, check here if you're non-Caucasian.
Yes.
Darn.
And
you didn't know that meant triple A status.
No,
up front.
And I said, you know, forget it. Here I am going to school with aeronautical design and academy of aeronautics. I want to go into the Air Force. I always loved the Air Force. I said, you know what? I'm not going to do this. I'm going to go into the Air Force. I fought it in court. I got a term delayment. I said, I'm going to the Air Force. I'm not going to the Army and be shipped off to Vietnam.
Right. I'm not going to go.
Went into the
jungle.
Air Force, we went to Lowry Air Force Base after basic training, but second base training.
Hey, you know what? That's
only 12 of us.
That's kind of like W. I hear he went into airplane stuff like that.
We'll get to W in a minute.
Another success story.
There was only 12 of us, and we all we had school. No teacher. We had a sergeant sitting in a room, and we did everything by television. All the instructions on television. Took the test in our desk, but everything, the instructor was on TV. And that's really the first. I guess it's the first, you know, what you can say, online classroom.
Mm-hmm.
We went to school 6 days a week, 8 hours a day. It was emerging into engineering aircraft abilities, but we came out and there was two places a week to go. He said, you got two places. We're going to draw lots for them. All right.
And by lots, we mean little pieces of bamboo.
Yeah. No, well, not bamboo yet. We want, anyway, so.
Well, you didn't think they were bamboo. You didn't know
yet. Paper and everybody that got the short piece of paper went to Rheinstein, Germany.
Ah.
Man, I wanted to get there. I got Georgia Air Force Base. Victorville, California.
That's
a population of 12. Seven are dogs.
Yes. And.
Prairie dogs.
And you might notice it's on the edge of an ocean.
And.
Where you might be.
The
going.
Launching pad for Vietnam.
Yes.
It was a launching pad for Vietnam. A launch. I mean, I knew it was bad when we took that 12-hour flight over there. And we couldn't get in because, Clark Air Base, where we were going to be a main station, was a foot and a half underwater. So they from a typhoon, so they diverted us to Okinawa for 2 weeks. And I can say, listen, I had a great time in the military. Dick, I had a great time in the military. Dick, but that's Cheney, that is. For you people who don't know. Anyway.
I was wondering, now you got to throw in the word deferment or something once in a while.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, help the people out. Talking about the capital letter Dick.
So I went to Vietnam. I went to Clark. I went to Thailand. We went bunch of ways. Anyway, it was great. I loved it. The best time in my entire life. But you see, we were in a different shape because we were more or less coddled because of the career field we were in. There was only six of us in all of Southeast Asia that could take care of these F-4s aircraft, which are brand new. So we had our own dorms, air-conditioned dorms. We had a bar in our dorm. It was fabulous.
Oh, my God. You had the champagne tour.
Fabulous, and Cameron Bay. But Clark was really the best.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we would TDY out to those to Vietnam, you know, 55, 57 days at a time. And
in between, there's nothing but barbed wire fences that people would throw themselves over.
Well, that was only in Da Nang during the defense. But getting back to Junior.
Well, Junior and Dick share that ability to miss wars and
well,
that's amazing.
At least Junior put on a uniform.
Well, that's because he knew that, you know, Dad would assure that he wasn't shipping out.
Dad, yeah, but if he didn't put on that uniform,
and actually,
Dad would have had the CIA come and get
well,
him.
Well, actually,
and he might have been the first prisoner.
Well,
Guantanamo.
we know that in truth that he there's a substantial question he ever did actually put that uniform.
Well, like, the problem is
they could never find a single person.
He does have pictures with it on. Okay, I saw a picture with a hand on the rail of the F-102. Now you see, here's the people don't know, the squadron that Junior was in, W. was a defunct, depleted, and not never, ever, 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 ever getting off the ground.
Yeah.
They used all the parts of those planes that where he was in the National Guard with as scrap. Because at that time, we were in the same time, the 102, which was our used at ADC, Air Defense Command, to protect the perimeter of the United States, was going bye-bye. They weren't using them anymore. They were 20 years old.
Yeah,
they were not using them anymore. They were never going to be shipped out. His unit was never scheduled to go to Vietnam because it was an obsolete aircraft.
Which is exactly why he was serving.
That's why he got in that. Ordinarily, he never would have gotten in it. So, now, but that's one portion of it. The other thing is, how come with all this talk about Did he serve D? Not serve D. Blah, 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 blah. He put on the uniform. Dickey did not. The problem is with W. Can we prove ever he didn't have reduction in pay for being AWOL? See,
yeah,
we have never seen
him. He was just a party boy. That's all.
That's fine. You're not nice to be the party boy. That's fine. But when you're in the uniform, you got to ration those parties. We have never seen a DD-214, and the problem is that most of the people who interviewed this man never were in the military, so they didn't even know what a DD-214 is. Because if you look at your DD-214, it tells you time you missed.
There
the
was
service.
Enough scandal over and, that. Everybody knows, because you remember they went looking for the records, all the news agencies, and they were gone, which is a federal crime in itself.
The problem is that he never showed it, so we can never prove that he was of AWOL or missed time.
Or that he served perfectly and he was at the top
that's
of the
right. He could have served perfectly.
He could have been
correct.
Superman, but
absolutely.
We don't know because he refused to ever prove.
If patterns seem to fall as the way they do, we got a quick calculator here. How many days of the year are there?
365.
365 times. That's 1 year times 8. 2,920
mm-hmm.
days
right.
in 8 years.
Right.
So calculate minus.
Minus W's.
Do you know how many days W took vacation when he was president?
Oh, well, I remember that. It seemed frequent.
1,029 days.
1,029 days.
That means he only was president under name, because he's never president. We know Cheney was president. But he was only president for 5.18 years.
So he took off almost one entire term that he was up there.
It was.
Oh,
he took off 2.81
years. 2.81
years.
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 Years. Over his terms. Do you know if a Democrat took off 2 years of their term, how many? Impeachment proceedings that were going
if
on.
If the kid at Food Lion took off 2.8 years, he'd be in jail.
If the kid at Food Lion took off 2.8 minutes past his lunch break, he'd be fired. That's what happens to real people.
Unbelievable.
So this guy took off 2 years of his presidency. And just, that's all.
Unbelievable.
Hey, if you remember, he took off the entire month before 9/11 happened. You remember that? He was off all of August, and then September 11, bam, what's an airplane? What? And, you know.
Oh, gosh.
But see, so this is a pattern with these guys. These guys don't serve. They don't perform their duties they're supposed to. We were laughing at Dick because this is the guy who got, you know, what, 4 or 5 deferments?
And we have a guest who is time for him to come on the phone. And
man, hello.
Is this Joe?
Yeah.
Hold on 1 minute, Joe. Hold on. We are, so he took off 2.8
years.
2.819178 years.
Wow.
During his presidency.
And this is now, as president. I mean, sitting in the Oval Office.
This
guy's taking 2 and 3 years.
And we won't be able to get to most of this because I didn't have it. There was so much on this other information that we want to get to Mr. Galloway. But
so
next
Joe
week,
Galloway?
It is going to, this we're celebrating this month, Dick's first deferment.
Deferment anniversary.
This is the deferment anniversary, 50 years. We'll talk about him more in depth But we'll, I'm sure we're going to get into them.
Because there's been some really interesting stuff on MSNBC and other channels about him lately and about the war in Iraq and the lies and cover-ups that accompanied such.
Well, you know. It's,
so we'll be talking about all of that.
We will definitely be talking about all of that. And at the moment, right now, I am going to be, let's see if I can pull this up here. Hold on just a minute. We will be pulling up and talking to the Mr. Joe Galloway, who is one of the great American newspaper correspondents. As former military affairs consultant for Knight Ritter newspaper. And I just wanted to, Joe, are you there? Let me put you on.
I'm here.
I got you, and I also have someone else you know on the phone, too. And who might this be on the other phone?
Well, this is Grace Galloway. I'm not going to be talking today. I'm going to listen to my husband.
Well, it's about time you did that. That's all I got to say.
That's proving it's never too late to start.
That's right. That's absolutely – well, see, you're doing exactly what the conservative movement says you need to do. Stay in your place. Yeah, we've seen that story before. Isn't that right, Joe?
Oh, many times.
Well,
so
I am so grateful to have you on this show to talk about your adventures that it's been over 40 years, am I correct?
Yes, it has. 43 and, years going to cover Americans at war.
And it is a Vietnam, I guess, and Desert Storm, or in Iraq, I guess, Afghanistan?
All of those.
You didn't meet
multiple times.
You didn't meet Grace over there, did you?
I met Grace in Southeast Asia over 40 years ago.
Oh my gracious! You know this is like. This is like, you know, did you ever see that English show that's on TV? And it's called what is that English show called? It's called As Time Goes By. Well, there's an English show on TV called, I love it, it's old, it's with who's the woman that played M in
Judy Dench.
Judy Dench. Anyway, what happens is that they meet in 1955, and they fall in love, and they don't, they promise to get in touch because he's in the military, and he gets sent off to Korea in 1950. So seems how that she had the wrong address. He gave her the wrong address to write letters, and he wrote letters. She never got the letters, and then vice versa. Never saw one another again. So
destiny.
Right. And then destiny, 30 years later, they bump in. He comes to her office because he's writing a book, and he needs to have it written up, typed up, and that's what her agency did. And then they meet. So is this one of these things between you and Grace?
Kind of, sort of.
Is that right?
Yeah, she fell off my radar in 1986. It's the last time that we spoke. And I didn't know where she went. And she turned back up in December of 2011. I said, where the hell you been, Gracie? And she said, I ran away to join the circus. And she had.
And she went to the circus, the Democratic Party.
Yeah, oh, well, that's a different circus.
Well, she was really a CIA analyst working for the Bush administration.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think so.
You know that lady that Bourne kept calling?
Yes.
Yeah, that one.
Oh. Right. Well, Joe, you know, there's so much. I don't even know. I think we might have to have a part one, part two, and part three with you. But in were you there when the Tom King resolution, or were you involved in any of the shenanigans when that was fudged up and created so we could go into Vietnam?
My recollection, the Tonkin Gulf stuff happened in 1964.
Yes, that's correct.
64, and I was on my way. I'd gotten as far as Tokyo. I'd been trying to get United Press to move me from a stateside assignment to Vietnam because I had a hunch war was coming. It was going to be my generation's war, and 40 years on, it would be a lot easier to explain why I was there than to explain as a reporter why I wasn't there.
Yes.
So I had managed to get moved to Tokyo, immediately asked to go to Saigon, and the boss said, oh, I just sent a second man to Saigon, and we'll never need more than that. So 4 months later, I was on my way to Saigon after the 1st Battalion of Marines landed.
Wow. Was your boss fired for being stupid or what?
No, he was. He was ultimately, but not for that decision.
Well, that decision.
So you've been at the forefront, major international. We'll call them discourses for decades. But interestingly enough, you know, talking about the Bush, Cheney, and Friends circus that we've been talking about. All of these wars and crimes perhaps seem to always involve the same people. Isn't that weird?
It's frightening. And, you know, I saw this from the outside mostly, but I also had a year on the inside as a special consultant to General Colin Powell when he was Secretary of State. And I worked for the man. I was sworn into government service on the 10th of September 2001, one day before 9/11.
Well, you know, we're going to talk about that, but I wanted to ask you a question about the way we got into Vietnam. Can you think of how the wars that we've gotten in after Vietnam are similar? In other words,
in my view, almost all of the wars that we have gotten into, with the exception of World War II, have either been unnecessary or mistakes. You know, World War II, there's no question. We had to fight that war. The Korean War, we didn't have to fight, except that Dean Acheson, the Secretary of State, made a mistake giving a speech and leaving South Korea off of the list of countries the United States was considered protectorates, and if anyone attacked them, we would fight. And he forgot to put Korea on, and the next thing you know, here they came boiling across the border and were drug into an unnecessary war. Vietnam was entirely unnecessary. It was begun on a fraudulent accusation of North Vietnamese gunboat attacks on our spy ships out there. And, you know, there's a whole lot of other things we could have spent our money and 58,000 lives of American sons that we could have spent that national treasure on than getting in the middle of somebody's civil war in a place like Vietnam where they've been fighting off foreign invasions for 2,000 years.
Gee, sort of similar like...
Exactly, just like Iraq. You know, you really need... When you're kids and you got to walk to school and back, and if you're a, ordinary Irish American and you got to walk through an Italian neighborhood, you're going to get beat like a drum unless you learn how to go around it.
That's right.
And we seem to not apply those principles to international relations. We keep picking out people to fight who love to fight, who consider it a hobby.
Right.
And that's dumb.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that, but these wars, now, are they justified because, or are they done because the people in power made a mistake, or are some of the people, the policymakers, want to prove that they have the biggest pair on the block?
There's some of both. And in the case of going to war in Iraq, Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld and this little committee of theirs, neoconservatives, 3 or 4 years before Bush won the election and gave them all a job, they had already written their plans to go into Iraq, to overthrow Saddam Hussein, and use Iraq as America's bully pulpit right in the heart of the Middle East, and we're going to change that place. We're going to change all of those countries out there. And, they came in, they had that on their agenda. When 9/11 happened and we were attacked in our country by people who were being sheltered by the Afghan Taliban, the first war conference they had up in D.C., those guys all said to Bush, now we need to figure out how to expand this war into Iraq. Here's our opportunity. So they went into this looking to get into it.
Okay, hold on 1 minute. I want to back up something you said with a little clip here. Just listen to this.
I think the United States, since Desert Storm, has always had a various planning with respect to Iraq. You go to war with the army you have, not the army you might want or wish to have.
So, and this is Donald Rumsfeld. I mean,
yeah.
He said exactly what you said. They always had plans to go into Iraq. Now, that is just I mean, they might have that the Rumsfelds and the Cheneys and the Crystals and the Fifes and the new American Century. These neocons, they wanted, in my estimation, the oil over there, and they just couldn't figure out how to get it. And Halliburton, as he says in the documentary that Showtime had, they were in they had 100,000 people and more people overseas. I think 70% of the people were overseas in Europe. So they were planning.
And they made profits of around $50 billion on that war.
Right.
Which is unconscionable for a company that, in the middle of it all, moved their headquarters to one of those Gulf protectorates, Dubai, I think.
Yeah,
they
Dubai,
moved
right.
their headquarters to Dubai so they wouldn't have to pay taxes on all the billions of dollars they screwed the American taxpayers out of.
Right.
That's Dick Cheney, and that's Dick Cheney's company, and they were paying him millions of dollars in deferred compensation every year he was in Washington, D.C.
That's
an outrage. He's an outrage. Every time I look at him, it just you know, my blood pressure just goes right through the ceiling. This guy,
well,
he says, you know, he would do it all over again. And I'm sure he would. He'd love to profit again. He'd love to put that money in his pocket. He never served himself. He had five, count them, five draft deferments to keep himself out of Vietnam. You know, and my question is, what about the five people who had to go in his place? What happened
right.
to them? Did they get killed? Did they come home with PTSD so bad they killed themselves? Are they suffering still? So that Dick Cheney, he said, I had better things to do. Well, so did the five guys who went in his place.
Absolutely. And this is what Cheney said. This was it.
My belief is we will, in fact, be greeted as liberators.
We're going to be greeted as liberators over there. There's not going to be any fighting.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and we're going to pay for the whole war with their oil money.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That
you
was,
remember that part of it.
And that was woeful.
They're going to throw rose petals at our guys, and we'll pay for it with their oil money, and we'll be out of there in 6 months.
Well,
this is one of the best lines ever. A free war.
Well, since you said that, let me play this clip for you.
There's a lot of money to pay for this. It doesn't have to be U.S. taxpayer money, and it starts with the assets of the Iraqi people.
That's right. The assets of the Iraqi people will pay for this war.
Mm-hmm.
And it would only be 18 months
so
long.
So far, it's only cost us $2 trillion.
Well, it's now up to
but
three.
But that's okay. Not counting 40 years of treatment for the veterans who were sent there on four, five, six combat tours of a year each, and 30-plus percent already diagnosed with PTSD, many of them with traumatic brain injury from the explosions. This is an outrage. And the one thing that I really was angry about. I supported Barack Obama's campaign the first time, and I was really pleased when he won that election. And 2 weeks later, after he was sworn in, he tossed out the principle of equality under the law.
Mm-hmm.
When he said, I don't want to look back, I'm looking forward. So we're not going to investigate Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and those war criminals. We didn't have to put them in prison, but we needed to have a Senate Select Committee that looked at all of their crimes and misdemeanors and what they did to our constitutional rights and at least exposed that to the public's view. You know, those guys, they can't really travel anymore. They can't leave the United States. If they go to Europe, somebody's going to slap a warrant on them, and they'll end up at the War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague.
Well,
and
they
rightly
could be snapped and taken, you know, whisked away. What do they call it, a rendition?
Rendition.
Yeah.
In a black site somewhere in Uzbekistan.
Well, you had mentioned
they're the ones who should be renditioned to Holland.
Right. That's right.
Well, you know what?
Put a bag on their head and strap them down to the floor of a cargo plane and fly them over there.
Well, that's what I mean. I find it troubling. I agree with you. I've talked with Mike 100 times about this, about the failure. I don't know why, but the Democrats. Over and over again, just like when Clinton went in, you remember there was investigations against Bush for the myriad crimes under the Bush years, but drug running and Contra and everything else affairs. But he let all that go and said, let bygones be bygones. Let's go forward.
You can't let bygones be bygones with the Republicans. It's not going to make them cooperate anymore. It's not going to lead to bipartisanship. all it's going to do is they're just going to keep trying to do away with you. And
right.
I don't understand it. I mean, President Obama grew up in Chicago politics.
Yeah.
And the way that's played is real hardball.
Oh,
right.
You learn with your mother's milk. You reward your friends, you punish your enemies, and he must have forgot all of that.
My only thing, I've talked with Mike 100 times about this, and Mike used to have a saying, with a vampire, it's not enough to stake them in the heart, because if anybody ever pulls the stake out, they come back, you got to break it off, And these guys have been coming back since, in the case of Cheney and them, they have literally been back in power since the Nixon years. They've come back over and over and over again. We've had the same
administration. And they all rush to write their version of history, which is complete and utter bull pookie.
Okay.
You need a sailor's vocabulary to describe.
Well,
what
they wouldn't know what you were talking about, since most of them have never been in the military, so they don't know about sailors or airmen or grunts.
Well, he did learn a few.
They don't know squat about any of that, but they don't care. Cheney sits there and continues telling the same lies over and over and over again in hopes that a few more people will come to believe what he's saying on the basis of zero evidence.
I think we talked about this for years, Mike and I have, and it is my belief. I mean, Cheney is he's a reprehensible person. He has no conscience at all. But I don't think
evil.
He's trying to – but he doesn't care. I think
he doesn't
the
care.
Only thing going on is that Cheney has a golden lockbox, if you want to call it, that he has information on Democrats in government or whatever. And there is some reason that everyone, from Obama on down, everyone in government refuses to prosecute the guy, no matter what he does. I mean, he's been tried and found guilty in every, international tribunal and war crimes tribunal and other nations like Spain and everywhere else. They've all investigated the guy because they have a modicum of guts. But over here, our government, for some reason, no matter how egregious the crime, they won't investigate him. They just let it go.
It's puzzling to me because the one thing that this country was founded on was the principle that we have equal rights under the law.
Right.
There is equality under the justice system.
But that's
that no longer applies. Now it's a principle newly established that if you've served a president in his administration and he and you have committed all kinds of crimes, when you walk away, they won't come after you.
Well,
right.
The reason why, Joe, is because there's a saying that from The Godfather, when Hyman told Michael, he told him this, just listen.
Michael, we're bigger than U.S. Steel.
He told Michael Corleone, we're bigger than U.S.
Michael.
And that's what it is.
Yeah.
They think they are so big that nothing can touch them. We've had in these 4,486 U.S. troops died so far. Over 32,000 wounded, over 108,000 Iraqis killed, 15.4 million persons have been displaced, and more, as we talked before, more than $3 trillion U.S. dollars have been spent. And it was supposed to take 18 months, and it took 9.5 years. I mean, what about
And the outcome is nothing like what they expected and wanted. you know, you overthrew Saddam Hussein, who was the single most effective counterbalance to Iran and the Ayatollahs and their evil doings. You may not have liked Saddam Hussein. He was a butcher, and he was hard on his own people, God knows. But, hey, he was Iran's number one enemy, and he kept them on the ropes.
Right.
And now the government that we installed in Baghdad are the best friends Iran ever had. They're letting Iranian aircraft fly across Iraqi airspace to provide the government in Syria with the weapons to use against their own people.
Right.
That's not something that was thought to come out of this incredible 9-year war that we fought, and at all that expense and all that blood that was shed, and we just don't have the ability to read something as subtle as a country in the Middle East and to tell if we do this, that may be the result. There was no thought given going in. There was just a rush to get in there and establish a principle in America that we will do preemptive strikes if we consider your country is plotting against us. We'll just take you out. And
right.
We never did that. We yeah. always stayed back.
Yeah, but this is you got to remember, I mean, it's one of the problems with the situation now is that Dick Cheney and them, their plan didn't come to fruition. They only got the first two, you know, pillars of their 3-point plan here, and that was Afghanistan, Iraq, and then third, we were supposed to be taking out Iran so that we could have the, unimpeded pipeline across the Middle East and control the entire Persian Gulf region. But what happened was history and or, you know, public opinion, the tide of we got too tired or whatever. We never did finish their plan, because if you look at the New American Century and all that, it was to take out those countries like, you know, dominoes. They were going to take them out 1, 2, 3.
Well, you know, the
preemptive war.
The preemptive war is one thing. But what I want to get at now is your take. How did you get over to Afghanistan or Iraq? Which one did you go to first?
I was in Afghanistan years and years before this all started. It was in my territory when I worked South Asia, and my headquarters were in New Delhi. And I made a couple of trips over, and in fact, I had just left there when they overthrew the king.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking 1974, 75, mm-hmm. something like that.
Right.
And everything went downhill from there. I went into Iraq the first time the Gulf War, the Persian Gulf War in 1990-91, I went in with the tanks of the 24th Infantry Division mechanized and rode it 250 miles across the western Iraq desert and came out behind them. And then I went back again in 2003, right after the invasion, to take a look at things, and I went back again in 2005 and 2006. And 2006, I looked around and I said, you know, there's something wrong with this picture. I'm 65 years old and I'm running up and down sand dunes behind 19-year-old Marines. So I quit.
All right. Now,
I quit.
Just a question about your time in Afghanistan, because, you know, again, with all these ties to the Bush, Bin Laden, you know, long-running relationship, during the Bush years, we were, of course, over in Afghanistan funding and creating al-Qaeda and using Osama bin Laden as our point man against the Soviets, you know, when they invaded. So were you over or involved in Afghanistan any time during that time period?
No, not really.
Okay. Because that would have been after.
I left Asia and went to the old Soviet Union, Moscow, as UPI bureau chief in 1976, and I was in Moscow till 1980, and I transferred back to the United States, my first domestic assignment in 16 years.
Wow.
Well, since you're that thorough with the old Soviet Union and Russia now, then you saw or you must have felt the lead up to the war when they went into Afghanistan.
I was there when they invaded, mm-hmm. and I went to see my minder at the Russian foreign ministry. Everybody, all the foreign journalists who were resident in Moscow had their own minder, somebody who read what you were writing and would object or protest or drag you in to complain. And I went off to see this guy, and I said, you know, you guys just invaded Afghanistan. Now, I want you to know something. I've been there. I know those people. And I got to tell you, that's going to be your Vietnam. You've just jumped on a bunch of people who love to fight. And, you know, if you know that I don't like your system, your government, and if you gave me a supercomputer and I put in all the parameters to find one people for you to go to war against, because I'm sure they'll kick your ass, it would be the Afghani people. The Afghani people of Afghanistan, they've been fighting off foreign invaders since Alexander.
Right.
We're talking 3,000 years they've been doing this, and they're happy to fight. And the guy said, well, you know, we're going to win this one hands down. Yeah, right.
And what was the reason? Remind the audience, what is the reason that they gave why they went into Afghanistan?
They didn't give a reason. They assassinated a guy who they put in power, and he wasn't to their liking, so they had him assassinated and then put another man in, but he was so unpopular they had to send their army in to back him up. And this launched a war that was, you know, cruel beyond all imagining. However we fight our wars, it's nothing like the Russian way of war, because they don't have any rules. They don't have any, you know, rules of engagement that say they can't do something. They do anything in their war in Afghanistan. They made mines to look like kids' toys, to look like butterflies and bunny rabbits and things, and dropped them all over that country, because a kid would pick it up, and when he did, it wasn't a big explosive, but it was enough to blow his hand off.
Right.
And then his family would have to take him and refugee to Pakistan to get medical treatment. Or somebody would come along and step on it, and it would blow their feet off. And that kind of stuff. And the Russians didn't care. They had no rules at all, but they still lost that war and had to leave with their tail between their legs. Wonderful.
Well, so this is a major a problem that we had, and when the Bush administration went into Iraq, they did have a chance to get and capture Osama bin Laden when they first went into Iraq, but they let the not Iraq, in Afghanistan. They had a chance to get bin Laden when they were in Afghanistan, but they let the Afghanistan army guard the back door, which probably Osama bin Laden had already paid off to get away.
Yeah, they just set up a toll booth and counted them through and took payoffs from them and let Obama and his Osama bin Laden and his senior people escape.
Well, see, this is what
once again that was with the CIA and their fighters had Osama bin Laden and the top people holed up in a cave, and they were asking for a company of U.S. Rangers to be sent up there to help block the trails out of there, and they were refused. General Franks refused on advice of not Dick Cheney, but Rumsfeld, to send that company of troops up there to put the cork in the bottle. And so they let him get away. And, that should never have happened. But Rumsfeld imposed all kinds of restrictions on the military. He wouldn't let them take any artillery pieces in there. He said, well, the Air Force will take care of all the fire support you need. Well, that's a nice theory, but, planes don't always fly. Sometimes they're fogged in. Sometimes in the mountains, they can't operate at all because of lack of any vision. You can't see the ground. You can't see the rocks in the clouds either. There's a lot of that in Afghanistan. They meddled constantly with stuff they didn't understand. And just screwed everything up for the military, who know how to do this. If you'll just tell them what you want done and get out of the way.
Well, the thing is that, you know, you have somebody who was in the Navy, so he doesn't know anything about bombing. But the thing is that, and also who got out before the Vietnam War, because Rumsfeld is another person who's, I consider, a draft dodger, because he got out when he was someone who was trained as a Navy pilot, and he got out when the war was declared. So, you know, he's another guy. But anyway, the thing is, what I wanted to know is that back door was not closed, and that artillery was not given to our soldiers because they had plans to use it in Iraq.
Yep.
It never was
from the day one of the action in Afghanistan, they were planning and beginning to move assets for the invasion of Iraq. They were determined to do it. They were going to do it, and nobody was going to stop them.
Well,
it's all war for profit.
And this is what George Bush said. Listen.
This is a regime that agreed to international inspections, then kicked out the inspectors.
And then he further said,
the people of the United States and our friends and allies will not live at the mercy of an outlaw regime that threatens the peace with weapons of mass murder.
But he could not, and this is where, we start seeing George Bush is political. George W. is political. Dick Cheney is agnostic. He doesn't care political from Shinola. All he wants to do is make money. So
he wants to make money, and he wants to gather all the power in his own hand.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Bush did not want, W wanted to go to Congress and say, look, I need a declaration from Congress, but Cheney would not do it. But Bush went to Congress. And let me just play a little bit here.
Important signal for the world to see that this country is united in our resolve to deal with threats that we face.
And here it is.
Our fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger. Our nation enters this conflict reluctantly, yet our purpose is sure.
So we got to this point where he convinced enough people in Congress by cherry-picking the intelligence that was delivered that they could use. Now, a question I have for you. How well did you know Judith Miller from the Times?
I know her only by reputation. I know that she, was a puppet. And it was Dick Cheney's guy, Scooter Libby, who had his hand up her.
Right.
And they were feeding her the worst BS that Ahmad Chalabi and his merry band of emigres could feed them. And
right.
And she was writing it up breathlessly, and the New York Times was putting it on the front page above the fold, giving her the best seat in the House to spread these lies. And, later, when she refused to testify during Scooter Libby's trial, they put her in jail for contempt of court.
That's correct.
They had the right person in jail for the wrong reason. She should have been
right.
in jail for lying.
Right.
And, the thing of it is if you examine this, there's something that's just dreadfully wrong when the two biggest cheerleaders for the Bushies taking us to an unnecessary war in Iraq were the New York Times and the Washington Post. Supposedly voices of liberalism, and yet their editorial pages were taken over by a bunch of right-wing cranks, and they supported that. You might as well have been reading the Wall Street Journal. They weren't doing their job.
Or listening
to... they weren't telling the truth.
Well, there's...
And that's the only... thing that we're supposed to do.
Well, that would be because you're an honest, actual reporter and a journalist.
The editor-in-chief, Keller, says in the documentary about Dick Cheney, he says that, they put the writings of Judith Miller on the first page, but all the misgivings that everybody else had in Section D in the third column.
Yeah.
They buried any bad news back with the truss ads or something.
The obituaries. And Valerie Plame talks about what you just said about a notorious liar called Curveball.
In the intelligence community, Curveball was known to be a fabricator. He could not be relied upon. His intelligence had been sort of stamped, do not disseminate. This is useless.
And then we have Curveball again.
In this 2011 interview with Britain's newspaper, The Guardian, the man called Curveball confirms the lies of his pre-war claims.
Imagine, could you go back to the past? Would you go back to the past of 2000 again? Would you tell lies again? Would you tell lies again? Yes, yes, definitely. I would do something against Saddam, against the old regime. I would do whatever I was possible to do.
So, this
guy is proud of his life.
He is the one who told the German intelligence people that Saddam Hussein was reconstituting his nuclear weapons and had yellow cake from Nigeria. So, this is when the intelligence community heard all this, they said, "Are you kidding me?" And that's where Valerie Plame's husband got in, Joe Wilson, who knew the people over in Niger, went over there and said, "Look, they're not doing nothing over here.
Right.
This is complete
they're
nonsense."
Not doing
and
nothing. They didn't provide the guy any yellow stuff.
That's
and
right.
And Saddam Hussein did not have any nuclear program development or otherwise, and had gotten rid of all of his weapons of mass destruction, his chemical weapons. But he was never going to admit that and stand up and say he didn't have these things because he used them to bluff Iran and the Ayatollahs. He lived in a bad, bad neighborhood, and he wanted everybody afraid of him.
Right.
And he didn't think we would attack him because it made no sense.
Well, he didn't think we would be that outrageously illegal. But again,
right.
with all of these people, with Miller and having the news on the front of the New York Times and, you know, Fox News running 24/7, all these talking, they were only repeating what was being fed to them. And what was being fed to them all came from, you know, the man behind the curtain, and that's Cheney.
That's who it was.
I mean, you remember Lawrence Wilkerson?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, he said
Wilkerson, Colonel Wilkerson. Yeah, he's my best friend.
Well, he said flat out in testimony that Cheney, for all practical purposes, was the first-term president of the Bush administration.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And he said also that his greatest fear today he lives in is fear of being tried as a war criminal. That's his one fear, because he knows what he did setting up these wars and how he lied and buffaloed the American people and forced us into an unnecessary war.
He should be worried. He should be worried, and I hope he forgets about it in time and gets on a plane and flies to Europe, because somebody will arrest him, and we'll get some justice yet.
Well, speaking about Colonel Wilkerson, who is a great man, let me play this for you.
Powell walked into my office, and without so much as a fare-thee-well, he walked over to the window and he said, "I wonder what will happen when we put 500,000 troops into Iraq and comb the country from one end to the other and find nothing." And he turned around and walked back in his office. And I wrote that down on my calendar as close to verbatim as I could. The profound statement coming from the Secretary of State, former Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
And it's so unbelievable. So and then when General Shinseki, the Army Chief of Staff, said, "We're going to need 500,000 plus for years," he was reprimanded.
Down.
He really was reprimanded and fired.
Yeah, he was just drummed out of there.
Well,
I mean,
they tried to fire him, but he served out his full term.
Right.
And Shinseki was absolutely right. He wasn't making any political statement. He was testifying before the Senate Armed Services Committee, and Senator Leahy pinned him against the wall and wouldn't let him off the hook. He demanded that the general say what he really thought we needed to secure Iraq after an invasion. And he ran our operations in Bosnia. And he knew that there's a formula. So many people that you're trying to control, you've got to have one soldier for every 15 or 20 people. And if you're trying to figure out how many you're going to need, there's a mathematical formula. And all he did was run the numbers on that formula and say that if we're going to secure Iraq after we invade it, we're going to need 400,000 to 500,000 troops as occupying force. And Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz went berserk. because they were trying to run this whole operation with fewer than 150,000 troops. They were going to overthrow the government, and they were going to install Ahmad Chalabi and his merry band of pranksters as the new government, and we would leave within 6 months. And none of this was going to happen. Everything was going to fall apart because they didn't know what they were talking about. And if any general stood up and challenged them, his career was over. They did their best to drive General Shinseki out of office. And he just refused to go. He's not a quitter. This guy lost a foot in Vietnam, stepped on a mine, got blown up. He don't run from anything.
Well,
and,
you know,
their treatment of him and the other generals in the Pentagon was disgraceful.
Yeah, well, they only picked the generals that could go along with them. That would follow the shoestring commands that they were putting out.
Yeah.
But the thing is that we have I believe the formula is that for every one military man that carries a gun, he needs at least 7 to 10 other support personnel. Does that seem like that's correct?
That's somewhere in the ballpark. I seem to remember in Vietnam it was 7 support troops for every guy with a rifle on the front line.
Right.
So somewhere between 5 and 8 in support.
And you see, the thing is that, you know, the Powell Doctrine was overwhelming force will get
absolutely
the job. Overwhelming.
And that's why the first Gulf War was done in 100 hours from start to finish.
Right.
You know, all the preparation was done. An overwhelming force was assembled. Everything that anybody needed was there in supply dumps. And when we went, boy, it went fast.
It went
fast. It was over with, and we could bring our boys home. But
right.
You can't do that always. It doesn't always work. But, you know, we certainly didn't get it right on the second invasion of Iraq, the 2003. It just drives you crazy.
Yeah, it's the difference between a justified and an unjustified war. The first war, to give Papa Bush some credit, is he had a legitimate reason, the invasion of Kuwait. He went in with a very narrow and specific goal, and he went in with overwhelming force, international support, and went in to the letter of the law, removed the problem, resecured Kuwait, and then withdrew and left. And so you can call it
the hell out. Yeah.
Well, he accomplished his goals and left by the letter of the law. He didn't say, oh, well, because you're an aggressor, we'll go ahead and take Baghdad too, and we'll take out Iran because they're nearby, and I think we'll take over Syria also because they're a bad regime. You know, he didn't just start doing whatever he wanted. He did what he was tasked to do, and then he got out.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the thing is that the whole idea was that, you know, again, quoting General Powell, if you break it, you own it. And the thing is that we sent in 150,000 troops, but we had to send them back 3, 4, 5 times because there wasn't enough. Now, how do you send a person back in line, on the line, 4 to 5 times and expect that person to come back just like it was a walk in the park?
Right. Yeah.
And then
going to be paying for the PTSD cases, the pensions, the medical care for these people for the next 45 years.
Well,
and it's
going
to cost another $2 trillion on top of the $2 trillion we've already spent.
Not to mention the horror of all of these people, what they're suffering, what their families are suffering, and
the loss of all these. We get what they say, there's over 2 to 3 suicides per day now from these soldiers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we're going to lose thousands upon thousands more for years now, for decades, because these people are going to just give up hope or be too damaged, and they're going to kill themselves.
Well, my wife in Charlotte here works at the VA clinic, and she's seeing mostly Vietnam vet cases come into her, because she's an acute portion of the clinic. And she hasn't started seeing many of the Afghan or Iraqi cases yet. So, and because this is a clinic, and they're supposedly building a hospital, I understand. Have you heard anything about that, Grace? Gracie. Yeah, well, anyway, Grace is listening. But anyway, the thing is that there's have you heard anything about the hospital here in Charlotte, the VA hospital they're building? I can't hear you because you're talking on your speakerphone.
I'm saying with the sequestration, it's on hold.
Yes. Well, you see, the thing is that we have these soldiers, as I said before, going over there 4-5 times. So instead of sending the 500,000 troops, getting this over, securing the country, securing the banks, not getting rid of the army like they did, they dismissed the entire army, which really caused the whole disruption of Iraq and this major backlash that we suffered through. All those things, what's his name, Dan Senor.
Brimmer.
Paul
Brimmer.
Well, Dan Senor was his assistant. I believe Senor was his assistant. They who knew nothing about how to maintain a country of, 8-10 million people?
They had no idea, and neither did their bosses. You know, from the get-go, when you go to invade a country and you're planning that operation, the military knows how to do this. They've done it before. They have what they call the tip fiddle, time phase deployment. And this looks like the New York City phone book.
Right.
And it's very, very dense. And it identifies the units that you need when in the scope of things they should be activated and when they should be arriving, because they know how to do this. They know that the first people you're going to need, besides a couple of battalions for security, you need the port workers, the experts in unloading ships to get your supplies in. And you need military police in large numbers if you're going to take a country that is hostile. You're going to need police to secure everything. You need military police. And so all of these units are designated, and the time when they are activated and brought forward is all very carefully worked out. And it's a delicate balance. And I got to tell you that when they started planning the 2003 invasion of Iraq, Don Rumsfeld sat at his desk with the tip fiddle and started line item by item. He'd say, well, we don't need these people. He'd scratch them off. Or we don't need these people at Thanksgiving. We'll activate them after New Year's. And he screwed everything up, because he didn't understand. He still doesn't. He is arrogant. He is that wonderful combination of arrogance and ignorance. And it's almost always fatal to somebody.
Well, I'll tell you one of the things that I find most disturbing about what the legacy, if you will, of the, I'll call it the Cheney program, arrogant ignorance that you're talking about. When you go in and just wage a war on an idea and not on reality, right? One of the detriments to our system that's, I think, going to be haunting for decades to come is that the lesson of Vietnam, you know, we ended the draft because, not because a draft worked or didn't work, really. It was because it was an unfair draft, to be honest. But we ended the draft and went to a voluntary system. And I will put it on the, you know, doorstep of George Bush, his presidency, or Cheney in his hands, that this man almost destroyed our volunteer military force because they ineptly ran the war so that they were forced, if you will, but willfully went into that backdoor draft situation where they forced volunteers to begin doing multiple endless deployments. And that almost broke our military, literally. And that's one of the reasons we have such a huge, like, I mean, they should have learned the lesson the first time. We still go to any park anywhere, go to any corner anywhere in any city, and you still find that legacy of Vietnam. But what they did in the deserts of Iraq and the mountains of Afghanistan is destroyed the modern volunteer military and the idea of it. Because you have people now that are scared to go in anywhere. You know, you can go into the National Guard now. You may find yourself in an endless deployment in the middle of Afghanistan. You know,
yep.
It's not quite.
That's
it's
absolutely
not quite,
correct, because what, they, you know, the numbers of our active duty military have been skinned down to the point where if you don't use the National Guard and the reserves to the fullest extent, you don't have enough people.
Well,
now, because of the sequester and the cuts, we're going down another 30,000-40,000 active duty. So an even heavier burden on the National Guard and the Army Reserves.
Which, well, of course, well, hits all of our communities.
Well, isn't it a fact that one of the main ideas of the neocons, the crystals, who never served a day in his life, so I don't know why he has anything to say about it, and the Rumsfeld and the Wolfowitzes, was that not to have a military, but a mercenary force that we don't pay them benefits. We pay a company.
Yeah, it's what he said he was going to outsource the military. He was going
right,
to outsource. The military.
Oh yeah, good old Blackwater.
So, right,
yeah.
It's another Blackwater. Well, we do not need a military. Well, we have to worry about them getting shot and coming back, and now we got to take care of them for the rest of their life. Well, we don't have to worry about if they need their teeth done. Well,
yeah.
We don't have to worry about if we need to pay for the hospitalization. This is what they, and with that, and along with the massive new influx of modern weaponry, we do not need a 500,000 standing or a 200,000 standing army anymore. I mean, isn't this what they actually wanted to do? But I think doing what they did showed that they can't do it because they have no idea how to do it.
That's absolutely correct. Their depth of ignorance is breathtaking.
Well, I want to play something for you to show some more depth of their ignorance.
Secretary of State Powell set aside his personal misgivings and staked his global reputation for integrity on this one moment, selling the case for war.
Though neither Powell nor anyone else from the State Department team intentionally lied, we did participate in a hoax.
Freedom's untidy, and free people are free to make mistakes and commit crimes and do bad things.
There are no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and there haven't been for a long time.
A new report by the chief U.S. weapons inspector finds that Iraq got rid of its weapons of mass destruction shortly after the first Gulf War.
I wasn't supposed to find WMD. I was supposed to find the truth. You know, I did not fail to find WMD. I succeeded in finding the truth.
You're telling us, in addition to having no WMD stocks before the war, for the reasons you gave, Saddam chose not to have those weapons. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Those are stunning statements.
It was a terrible mistake. The CIA had said we would find stockpiles that we didn't find. It was a disaster.
And you believed it was true at the time?
Yes, so did they. They shouldn't have. I mean, there were a lot of people in the agency, in the community, that knew some of this information wasn't, you know, as solid as it was being presented to me.
It's not just an intelligence failure. It's a failure to the very highest levels of decision-making in America. George W. Bush and Richard Bruce Cheney would have gone to war with Iraq and gotten rid of Saddam Hussein, even if there wasn't any intelligence at all. Lies and deception. It is at best incompetence and lack of understanding.
A lot of people who purposefully used extreme rhetoric to gin up popular support for the war, there have been no consequences for them.
We sit here some 8 years later, 4,000 Americans lost their lives, maybe 100,000 Iraqis lost their lives. It cost about $1 trillion. Was it worth it? Did you give the right advice?
I think I did. If you look back at the proposition we faced after 9/11, with respect to Saddam Hussein, we were very concerned about the prospects of terrorists like the 9/11 crowd acquiring weapons of mass destruction, biological agent or nuclear weapon that they could use on the United States.
There's no question the news media didn't do its job during the run-up to the Iraq war. Far too often, the press simply accepted these sweeping assertions by the highest officials in the government without looking for the hard evidence to support it.
I was more concerned about the politics of my decision rather than what is right and what is wrong.
And that last part was from North Carolina's Republican Walter Jones. Representative Jones said this also.
One of the most serious responsibilities Congress has is to cast a vote to send a young man or woman to war to die. If I'd read the National Intelligence Estimate on Iraq, I probably would have been, I've done myself a favor by being better informed on the intelligence rather than listening to the administration. In my heart, I knew that a no to the authority for the president was the right vote, but yet I was not strong enough to vote my conscience.
I mean,
it's astounding that a Republican congressman actually admits that he was flim-flam by his own president and vice president. This is, you know, after it was all done, said and done, the Bushies blamed it all on poor intelligence. And that's not where the fault rests at all, because they themselves twisted and perverted the intelligence. They salted the mine with poor information that was unreliable and untrue, and then blame the intelligence community for providing this information when they didn't provide it at all. It was provided by political operatives under Dick Cheney's thumb.
Yep.
From Curveball to the Brits. The English provided the Niger yellow cake tip. They provided other bogus information that just led the way straight into this war. And and then when it goes bad, they blame the CIA. Well, there was one man to blame at the CIA, and it was the then director, George Tenet.
Correct.
Yeah.
And George sat there in a meeting with Colin Powell before his UN speech. Three nights they met at Tenet's office in the conference room at CIA, and Scooter Libby was there representing Cheney, and he laid out all of the backup for what they wanted Powell to say in his speech. And he kept looking at it and saying, that's nonsense. That's BS. Right. He was throwing it out by the handful because he knew the good stuff from the bad stuff, and he wasn't seeing any good stuff at all. And finally, in desperation, Tennant told the Secretary of State, his friend General Powell, I guarantee this information, it's solid gold. You can take this to the bank, Colin. And so he said, well, George, you better be right, because you're going to be sitting beside me at the UN. And if you look at the film, that's exactly where Tennant is, sitting and right over Colin Powell's right shoulder. Okay. And a year later, after the invasion, after they had combed that country with a fine-tooth comb and found zero nuclear program, zero biochemical war agents, Powell called George Tennant on the phone. He said, and Tennant said, George, oh, he said, Colin, I've been meaning to call you. I wanted to apologize over that WMD stuff. And Powell said, George, I didn't call you for an apology. I called to tell you that next week I'm going to demand a full investigation of how the intelligence became so twisted and perverted in your hands. And he hung up. And the following week, George Tennant resigned as director of CIA.
Yep.
Yeah. And it should have been, and you know, it wasn't long afterward that George W. Bush stood on a stage and presented the Presidential Gold Medal of Freedom to George Tennant, General Tommy Ray Franks, and that insufferable ass Paul Bremer. Yeah. The Tsar of Baghdad. You know, a friend of mine called me up, said, quick, turn on your TV. Bush has given a medal to these three guys. I think he's going to bring Saddam Hussein out and give him a medal, too. Just an outrage. The three biggest authors of the failure in Iraq, and he's hanging presidential medals around their neck.
That's because it was the Presidential Medal of Freedom to keep your mouth shut. Yes, that's what that was.
Well,
called.
Listen, I want to hear.
That's what that was about.
I want you to hear what else Bush said. Listen.
Was there ever any consideration of apologizing to the American people? I mean, apologizing would basically say the decision was a wrong decision, and I don't believe it was a wrong decision.
It was the wrong decision.
I'm not going to apologize.
Well, you know, the thing is that he has to apologize, and I don't know if you were on the air when we were talking about this. The man served, I think it was 2,965 or 85 days in 4 years. He was supposed to be president of the United States. He was on vacation 1,029 of those days.
Yeah. He was like 2 years off.
2.81 years. He did
and the,
not.
And the Republicans complained that Barack Obama went off for a golf, round of golf,
with
Tiger Woods.
Right.
Yeah. Hey, they claimed that Obama's lazy.
Yes.
This guy took off 2.5 years.
I mean, but the thing is, it's so bad that they can't get anything on Obama. Now they're talking about his kids. I mean, it is horrendous. It is just horrendous and racist.
Well, you know they don't have any honor. You remember they went after Chelsea and everything else. I mean, these people have no honor whatsoever.
One thing I want to ask you, Joe, and that's about who I think has been really great in this, and that's General Anthony Zinni.
Tony Zinni's a great man.
Mm-hmm. And
very, very sharp mentally. His analysis of the situation in the Middle East has always been top rated.
Well, what else can you tell us about the general?
Well, I could tell you that, you know, he had done planning, contingency planning for an invasion of Iraq, and he knew how many troops it was going to take. He had worked up war plans that were sitting on the shelf. And when Tommy Franks was given the job at CENTCOM as commanding general, the first thing that Rumsfeld told him was throw out all those old war plans because, you know, everything has changed because of what we did in Afghanistan, how with fewer than 7,000 American troops and, you know, the CIA running an army that it bought for green dollars, we could overthrow a government with fewer than 10,000 men in total. So we should be able to do that in Iraq. But it was wrong, and Zinni knew it was wrong. And Zinni is going to tell you the truth. When you ask him a question, he will speak the truth, whether you like it or not, and the Bushies did not like that, and they did not like him.
Well, right.
He's one of the few that actually opposed the invasion.
Right. Well, I have a clip here. General Zinni says, you know, he couldn't believe. He said he almost jumped his seat when Bush, Cheney was at a American Legion speech, and he was there getting a medal. Just listen to this.
What I was hearing and what I knew did not jive. I asked one time at Langley, am I crazy or is there no credible evidence of an ongoing program? And I had a former deputy director of CIA said to me, you're not crazy.
So, you know, he said,
There it is.
There it is in a nutshell. I mean, it's just so irrational. But people don't take the time to see what their government is doing. This is a representative government. This is not a democracy. And we elect these people to do certain things, to represent us. And the
so much better off if we went back to a conscript army, a draft.
Absolutely.
Then everybody has skin in the game.
Absolutely.
Well, only if it's an actual fair draft.
Yeah.
Not a rigged draft. Rigged draft where it's just the poor and the ethnic, you know, populations serving, but everyone. If it was a completely.
Oh, exactly. I've proposed for years that we institute true national service. So that every kid on reaching 18 and in, you know, good physical and mental health will owe their country a minimum of 2 years service. And I give them a choice from the Peace Corps to the Job Corps. Recreate the Civilian Conservation Corps and rebuild our nation's parks, a hospital corps, a teaching corps, they do 2 years honorable service. When they get out, they get a 2-year free ride at any college in the country. And if they want to serve in the military, they got to sign up for 4 years and they get a 4-year free ride at any college in the country that'll have them when they finish their service. Then if congressmen have their grandkids facing that obligation, that they may be very careful about how quickly they vote to go to war.
You think?
Yeah.
And listen,
that's a very
2000.
I like it.
The 2000, I was part of the draft clock for president, Wesley Clark, General Wesley Clark. I was the head of all the volunteers in North Carolina. And that's when Thomas and I met. And that's what he had on his agenda, the same exact thing he wanted to do, national service. It's done in Israel. It works fine in Israel.
done in all the European countries.
They've done in all the European countries. So, but you see, we have too many of the elites who don't want that.
Of course.
Of course they don't. They're quite happy with how it worked for them in Vietnam. They didn't go. Cheney didn't go.
No, none of them did.
Well, none of them did. None of them went. None of the neocons went. I mean, Crystal, Lombard, Hannity, O'Reilly, you name Rumsfeld.
Chicken Hawks, every one of them.
All the Chicken Hawks. None of them went.
They all have a bumper sticker on the car.
And they all have bumper stickers. I mean, it's just...
Hey, Mike, you know, where's your lapel pin?
Yeah.
That's all that matters.
Boehner. Yeah, I mean, you could just name them. McConnell.
Oh, Mr. Tangerine Man.
It's the Tangerine Man, right. Yeah, John Boehner, I should say. John Kyle, Cornyn, Ensign. I mean, you could just name Rob Blunt.
I don't know how you can say all of those names in one breath without stopping to spit.
Well, you know, he's gotten good at it. He swallows his own vomit.
I do. I learned how to do that. I learned how to swallow my own vomit.
But here's the thing. That would create an entire new industry if we had national service, mandatory national service.
Absolutely.
That industry would be.
It would create a renaissance in this country.
Yes, it would. But there'd also be medical deferments for rich people. Every rich kid's child would be sick.
Well, you know, Rush Limbaugh had a pimple on his ass, so he could not serve. So, you know,
technically speaking, I think it was a boil, not a pimple.
I'm sorry. Well, I get my pimple.
Hey, there are technical terms for these things, like syphilis and gonorrhea.
Oh, is that what it was? Oh, okay. Well, I want to tell you, it has been a great – and, you know, we're not finished with this, Joe, because we didn't even get on Dick Cheney yet. But
it'll have to be part two for that.
It's going to be part two. That's going to be part two.
I don't want to hear that.
And
we got to jump on Dick.
We got to jump on Dick. But the thing is that, is it possible next week that you could come on and do a part two with us?
Talk Cheney.
And we'll talk Cheney.
I think I'm in D.C. next Friday.
Okay. Well, what we'll do is I'll get together with your ringmaster, Grace. And we can see what date you can come back.
She'll work it out with you.
Yeah, we're in D.C. Next Friday. Joe's a keynote speaker at a reunion. He's so very well loved by all the veterans.
Right. Okay. Well, that's great. And so we'll work it out when you can come back. But because And I want to say these clips I played were from the documentary that MSNBC had, Hubris, which if anybody hasn't seen it, I don't know if you can get it on demand. I don't know where it's at. Maybe you can call them and you can write them and say, hey, look, I want to get a copy of it. Because, when I saw it, I then went online to read more in depth. And I am so shocked. Because I was recording it and recording the clips, it really wasn't sinking in. But when I read the transcripts, I could not believe it. It's just like I was living in another world.
Yeah.
The
book was very well written. I mean, David Korn and Michael Isikoff. I read the book years ago when it first came out. It was very, very good. And I'm so I'm ashamed to tell you that while it was very informative, it really wasn't well received, primarily because, you know, they were saying things that were very controversial. But think about this. Even when Hubris came out, we had already been in the war, all right? But before we even went into the war, where you had all these journalists, all these mainstream media, essentially beating the drum for the Bush administration to go to war. Very, very few. There was a tiny handful of journalists that actually said no. And they asked the right questions. They posed the right. They said they pointed out all the fallacies of the claims of the Bush administration. But then I'm telling you, you know, while David Corn may very well have been one of them, and Michael Isikoff may very well have been one of them, they didn't nearly touch what that small group of knife-fitter journalists in Washington, D.C. did. They were known as the four bad boys of journalism. And these were the four bad boys of knife-fitter, and my husband was one of them. Joe Galloway was one of them. And to the point where Rummy actually asked for a meeting with Joe, because Joe was skewering his columns. The next time you talk to Joe, you should ask him about that. It was hilarious. I mean, really.
Well, I'm sure it's going to come up when we talk about the Cheney documentary that was just on Showtime, because we want to do that at our next meeting on part two with Joe.
One thing I'd also love for Mr. Galloway to get into, aside from the war and Cheney and all this, but that other side of reporting that we've talked about, you know, with like faux news and all this stuff where they've just thrown reporting completely out the window. I would love for him to talk about restoring true reporting to this country, the true integrity of factual reporting.
Yes. And I think that that's very important. I think that's a really good point because, you know, true journalism is dying a rapid death.
Ain't that the truth?
But see, there are those four estates of government, and if you do not have a true, strong, free press, you have no counterbalance whatsoever to the politics of the nation.
The thing that okay.
No, you're right. No, journalism is true journalism is dead.
Absolutely, it is.
What you have now are the little pieces of fluff that really want to look pretty, who don't really want to do journalism. They just want to be able to go on TV with perfect hair and perfect nails and perfect teeth.
Well, you know, the thing is, it's no longer the Walter Cronkites or the Dan Rathers or the Huntley and Brinkley's. You don't see that no more because it's not about news. It's about selling sensationalism.
Right.
And if it doesn't get your attention in the first first 1 minute, it's not working.
Yeah.
It's working. Exactly. And I don't know if you've seen or you like, there's a HBO series called Newsroom.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what it should be like. And it is no longer like that.
That is a shame. It's a shame, and you know, Joe will say when he was coming up in the business, there was only one adjective that was applied to journalism, and that was fearless. And so when all of this stuff came about, you know, where the drumbeat to war, where all these journalists were just going along with what they would get fed a line, and they would publish it. And the Bush administration, would use the publishing of this particular line that they had just fed the journalist as say, well, look, see, it appeared in the New York Times, or see, look, it appeared in the Washington Post, when they were the ones who initiated this lie.
Right, it's just a loop.
But because their puppet published it, it now became a truth. Wait a minute.
Yeah. It's just
Machiavellian. Way of running things, but
it's in the news instead of
facts. Yeah, what they were afraid of was they were afraid of access, losing their access.
Right.
They were afraid of losing their access to the White House. Well, I can tell you that the four bad boys of Knight Ridder didn't give a rat's patoot about losing their access. In point of fact, they never lost a second worth of access. They got as much as they wanted because they were printing the truth. And so these people, you know, maybe they didn't get to see Rummy or Cheney, not that they wanted to, but their lines of information, their lines of communication from people who knew the truth and spoke the truth was just infinite. Because these were the people who said, you know what, we want to talk to the Galloways and the Walcott. We want to talk to them because they will tell the truth.
Right, because they could trust them.
Exactly.
And the other thing is, you don't need to speak to a Cheney, because anything that Cheney knows, the person below knows.
So, you know, how do you know when Cheney's lying? Isn't this the movie, right?
Absolutely correct. So, you know, but the thing is that now, you know, the newsrooms and the news, the newsrooms on television did not have to make money.
Right.
They didn't have to make money. Today,
well, now they're a commercial enterprise.
It's a commercial enterprise. It is no longer, they say a news division, but hey, just like MSNBC, it's no longer in the news division. It's part of the entertainment division.
Right. And they don't even have all other countries or anything anymore. They don't have foreign correspondents. You know, one of the things, Dr. Grace, that you said a minute ago struck me. The requirement for reporters in the old days was fearlessness, right?
Uh-huh.
And this is, look at the start of his career. We were talking about just earlier, Ms. Galloway said, how this all started. He asked to be taken overseas, and he wanted to go where news was going to occur.
Right.
It wasn't even occurring there yet, but he says, I'm going to go to where the news is going to be. And so he got himself to Vietnam before it starts.
Right.
So this is a true reporter going out of his way, doing everything possible, putting his life at risk to go and find the news story of the day. He's not a talking head mouthpiece back home with a, you know, worrying about ratings and selling macaroni or whatever.
And you know, here's the thing: when this the last invasion of, and I call it the invasion of Iraq, when that last invasion of Iraq occurred, and they were talking about embedded journalists. Let me tell you about embedded journalists. Joe Galloway is the original embedded journalist. Okay. And but the difference is that Joe was with, you know, the first of the seventh in Idrang Valley, being shot at and having to put his camera, and he had to put on the hat of the soldier. He had to fight. There was no script for him. Let me put it that way. There was no script. Whereas these guys right now, you know, who are embedded, they have a script to follow. They have bullet points to file. And it's just really like the 5 o'clock follies in Saigon, which we call the 5 o'clock follies, which is, you know, at 5 o'clock every day, you got a briefing from MACV. Well, you know what? I mean, all right, so we thought, how many buffaloes did you kill? Seriously.
Right.
It was the 5 o'clock follies. It was just, it wasn't fact. It was just whatever they chose to divulge as information, or what passed information.
It's kind of sad, the Republicans did with news. You know, they created, you remember, they wanted to create an alternative news channel, their own channel, so they created Fox News. They wanted to, you know, discredit and dismantle true journalism in this country so that they could get away with things without being questioned. So they even, you know, co-opted things like embedded journalists, and it actually becomes a controlled journalist that, you know, you're on the bus or you're on the airplane and you're given your talking points to regurgitate, which is exactly like that communist state. You know, when we were talking earlier about the Soviet Union and you had your minder standing there, well, you know, you got your Republican little administration minder standing there with your talking points already pre-written for you.
Exactly.
And that's not news. That's not reporting anything.
Well,
what
I want to also do, just mention quickly, what is the story with the IP law here in North Carolina?
With what in North Carolina? I'm sorry, I was Smead.
What is the story? Where are we at with the ID law in North Carolina?
Voter ID laws. Holy cow.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
My gosh. Well, you know, here's what I have to say to everyone who has any care at all about democracy, about where we are as a state in North Carolina. We need to let our voices be heard. Now, here's the thing. Most of the people in Raleigh, you know, the Republicans, feel that they are in safe districts because you've gerrymandered the map of North Carolina so badly that they pretty much are in they think they're in safe Republican districts. What we've got to do is we've got to, again, we've lost our way. We've lost the way we message. Now, I know I don't want to sound like, you know, what's his name, Prince, the Republican chair. They had a lousy message. So no matter how the Republicans reword their message, it's not going to resonate.
Right.
We have a good message. We have a good message. We have to tell people what a Democrat stands for. We have to tell, we keep reminding them, but every social program that has helped the people was passed by a Democratic Congress, passed under a Democratic president. We have to keep saying that. But more than that, we have to show. People you can talk to people until you're blue in the face, but you got to show people, like, this is what being a Democrat means.
Right.
And if we don't put our money where our mouth is, you know, we have, in the 8th district, for example, we have some of the highest, we have 13 counties. And of the 13 counties, I think something like 5 or 6 of them are the top percentile as far as children in poverty. We have a high percentage of children in poverty in North Carolina. I know I'm deviating a little bit from the voter ID bill, but here's what we need to do. We have to change the message a little bit.
Again, Grace, can you say that again?
Yes. Yes. We have, in the 8th district, we have 13 counties in the 8th district, and we have about 5 of them that are in the highest percentile of children in poverty in North Carolina. Okay? And then we have 44, Sarasota County is 25%. Robeson County is 44%. I mean, you have a ridiculously high percentile of children in poverty in North Carolina. What we've got to show people is that Democrats care. They've been frightened. The Republicans have frightened people to thinking that if Democrats win, you know, if we're going to win on the backs of illegal votes, and we're going to take away their rights and everything like that. What we've got to do is show them no. Democrats, this is what's happening right now. We have such a high percentage of children in poverty in North Carolina that if we don't do something about it, if we allow this present group in Raleigh, these thugs in Raleigh, to continue, we will have more and more poor children in poverty. And right now, maybe it doesn't impact you, but if we can allow them to continue this way, it will impact you. And then start off with that message and then say, okay, now let's talk about the voter ID bill. Right? What do you think it means? And that's why how I start my conversations with them. What do you think it means, this voter ID bill? And piece by piece by piece, just dispel the fallacy behind the voter ID bill. I found that if I get up there, the voter ID is a bunch of crap, which it is. I lost my audience immediately.
Right.
So what I've done is I've changed my messaging. I've changed the way I approach it a little bit. And I ask people, what do you think? What does it mean to you? What does this voter ID mean to you? And I've had people say to me, well, it's going to stop illegals from voting. And so then I'll ask them, how will that happen? You know, like, well, we have to show a vote, an identification card when they vote. And I said, actually, you know what? It's not the voting process that's the problem. It's the registration process. Okay? We have to hit the errors during the registration, not during the voting. By the time you get to voting, you should have been vetted.
That's right.
So, right. And it's hard for people to disagree with that kind of argument. We cannot allow this to take hold.
Right. Let me read real quick just some percentile facts here. So the voter ID will affect. There's 10% of North Carolina voters, registered voters, who have no ID. So right there, you're taking 10% of the electorate off if this passes. Right. So here goes. It says of the registered voters who lack state issued IDs, 53% are Democrats.
Absolutely.
25% are senior citizens. So you're taking a quarter of all senior citizens off, and then 30% of all those are African American. Again, you're hitting Democrats, African Americans, and seniors. That's your target audience to affect you.
It absolutely nothing to do with illegal voting. Nothing at all. It's targeted to absolutely diminish the ranks of people who vote Democratic,
sure.
And thus diminish the ability of Democrats to become to regain the take Raleigh back or to be elected in. That's all it is. That's all it is.
Exactly why when the Republicans took over the new North Carolina Congress, and January, Representative Frank Eiler said their number one agenda, number one thing on the table, was to force through a voter ID law. He didn't say create jobs. he didn't say fix education in North Carolina. He didn't say, improve our roads. He said their number one thing was voter ID. Now, why would that be number one?
Well, but McConnell said his number one was make sure Obama don't have a second term.
Right. Well, this is I'm just saying. You can take them for their word. So, the Republicans' number one agenda when they take over the Congress for the first time in 120 years is to stop voting.
Yes. It's to take away the basic principle of what this country was founded on, one person, one vote. Yes, just take it away.
And the thing is that, well, it's just like this. Just listen to this for a minute.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
Now, that's the far.
I just cannot believe that somebody has the cojones to stand up there and talk about taking away the rights of the average. I'm flabbergasted. But they're proud of it.
That is the father of the conservative movement, Paul Weyrich. He said this years ago.
Yeah.
They don't want everybody to vote.
Doesn't. No. That's exactly right. They don't want everyone to vote. They don't.
And you know what?
And what I love about that is that they wrap that somehow into they're the patriotic Americans.
Right.
Yep.
And Paul Weyrich never was in the military either.
I actually had
a Republican say to me that we need to go back to the old days where only landowners were allowed to vote. Really? Really? Yeah, you can only vote if you own a house. Really?
So if you live in an apartment or you live in a condo,
right.
You can't vote.
Only if you own, can you vote.
Well, in our new world where corporations are people, that might work out really well for corporations.
Oh, absolutely.
They own a heck of a lot of property.
Well, you see, this is so ludicrous. And why? Why don't people see this? Now, I think.
But they only see the bumper stickers.
Let me back up on that a little bit. I think they do see this. I mean, Obama won by almost 5 million more votes. The problem is that everyone, the House by more than a million votes. So they did turn out. The problem is that these
jury-rigged districts are going to be here now for another 10 years unless they're overturned in the courts.
Right, which is exactly why we've had two terms now of Obama getting virtually nothing done because he's being stymied by jury-rigged Congress.
Well, I just want to say one last thing to you, Grace, is that I want you to make sure you treat Joe good and the baby good so he can come back. Don't give him no hard time.
Listen, he doesn't get the first bit of hard time from me. He really
right.
doesn't. Impossible because he's so easygoing, so good natured, really.
Well, when he says he wants the margarita with a lot more salt, put more salt on it.
All right. Okay. Well, Michael, it's been a pleasure.
It's not just the salt now. Come on, remember, this isn't just salt on the rim of the glass. This is destiny. After all of these years.
That's right.
Yeah.
You need to watch as time goes by on...
Well, I have. It's Judi Dench. And by the way, I just want you to... Geezer Love is really fun.
Which one?
Geezer Love is really fun.
Viva!
Okay. So I'll talk to you next week.
Together with you so we can get Joe back on the show.
I will. We'll arrange it. All right?
Okay.
Thank you, Dr.
Thank you. Okay,
bye-bye.
Thank you. Okay. I think
we got a whole hour.
A little more than an hour.
Mr. Galloway.
Hour and 45 minutes.
Talking truth. I like that.
Hey.
We need more of that. If we had more of that, we might not have had 10 years of war in this country.
I mean, you know, can you, listen, you know, before I forget, we got a problem also, another problem in this country.
Oh, wait, there's more.
Guns.
Oh.
And I want everybody who's listening, I want you to get a hold of your congressman. And you can get them at 855-440-4800. That's 855-440-4800. And this is, demand action to end gun violence. And there, or they also can be reached at www.demandaction.org. And there are people, senators, who do not want these straw purchases. Now, you know what the straw purchases are. The straw purchase is like what happened just recently to the head of prisons in Colorado who opened up his front door and was shot down. The guy who did it was on the lam.
Right.
Somebody saw the car and got a partial plate, I believe it was. The next time they saw this guy it was in Texas. And a policeman was stopping him because he went past a stop sign or a red light.
Just a regular traffic violation.
Traffic violation, gunfight ensued, blah, blah, blah. Bang, right. Bang, bang, cop got shot, high-speed chase, car turns over, the guy dies.
Yeah. Well, then they found out
that gun was the same gun.
Yeah.
And how they found this guy now is a felon who had just got out of prison about a month before, or 2 weeks before.
Yeah, so how does a convicted felon end up with a gun?
Well, that's a good question. I'm glad you asked that, because that's why they call it a straw purchase. It seems this 22-year-old woman, she looked like she's 82, but anyway, 22-year-old woman.
That's the ravages of meth.
Right. Well, she bought the gun for him and gave it to him.
Oh, what a
because
thing to do.
Evidently, he would not have passed a background check.
Oh. Something about felonies that do that.
Yes. That is called a straw purchase. So there is a, as part of the gun ban and everything that's been going through the Congress, they have a one portion of it is called straw purchases.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some senators who don't even want that.
Yeah, there's these NRA puppets that don't want anything.
Well, I'm going to name them. Senator Hatch from Utah. Graham, South Carolina.
Graham. Do the right thing, Graham.
Jeff Sessions. Ted Cruz. Texas.
Cruz. Yeah, well,
Mike Lee. John Cornyn.
Cornyn.
And Jeff Flake. These people are going to vote or have voted against straw purchases. Now, this is just beyond me. While it's okay to have a gun, you buy it because you can, and then give the gun away. You can't do that with a car. Of course, they'll say yes, but a car is not in the Constitution. It's not a right. Well, it don't say that in the Constitution either. It says through a legal militia,
right,
regulated militia, you can have a gun. Your own person doesn't count as a regulated militia, because who's regulating you?
Right.
Regulated means that somebody other than you is regulated.
Right. And it says specifically it's regulated by your state, and it was supposed to be for the defense. But
defense.
Okay. Anyway.
Right. All right. So.
But anyway, let's.
I don't care. You want a gun for your house? Fine. Hey, I want that gun registered. Every single. Don't guns have serial numbers on them?
Right.
Why are those numbers written down?
Right. They've talked about this for years. We have the technology now. Every gun is regulated. They can have, you know, the NRA has fought and defeated this. You know, just like they have rifling inside a gun that,
yeah,
when you shoot it,
right,
you can go and determine what is in a body,
right,
that it
how
came from
that,
a gun.
Is that in the Constitution?
Well, of course not.
Oh,
but they want all this
what?
Stuff stopped because they've had the ability for years. You can put serial numbers on every bullet. You know, you can have every part of a gun identified perfectly, and it can be registered to a single individual. They fought against that. They've even gone so far as they have the technology now. They can DNA register your gun, and it won't even fire unless you hold it.
Yeah. Right.
But no, they defeated all that. They said that takes away your rights. No, why?
How does that
if
take away
your
rights?
If you want a gun for defense, great.
Right.
It should be registered to you, though. It shouldn't be registered to the local skinhead felon down the street. I mean,
no.
What, you know. Why is this even an issue?
Because
because there's no profitability when you can't sell 55,000 guns a year.
Well, and this is the problem. We talk about the nut job that killed all the kids in Connecticut. Why did his mother need all those guns?
No joke. He had something like this in his car alone. He had 3,000 rounds or whatever. I mean, are you kidding me?
He had, and he said, if it was only for target shooting is one thing, but the containers, the round, the drum that had all the rounds in them, the 30 rounds, mm-hmm, he took the ones with lesser rounds. He left at home.
Right, because it would run out.
He would run out too fast, and he had to change too fast. So he was going into a school where nobody was going to shoot him back. He was going into a school where he could kill as many people as possible.
Did you see that report where they were showing the difference? I think Matt Al did it, but where they were showing the difference in the amount of the speed and the amount of rounds he had per clip. And if he had normal clips,
right,
how he could not have killed more than, what, three, four
right
kids in that time.
Right.
And even
because he's only in there less than 5 minutes.
Right. it was only because of these extreme amounts that he had the ability to do.
So he wanted to kill as many as possible.
As humanly possible.
As humanly possible. All right. Psychopath. No. Crazy. Yes. Maybe unbalanced. Yes. The problem is his mother was too, because she knew he was that way. How did he get a hold of guns? Why wasn't the guns in a locked safe in the house?
Right.
So his mother is the real culprit, was the real culprit, because she's dead now.
So here's what it was. He fired 150 rounds, or 54 rounds in less than 4 minutes.
Right.
And he had 1,600 rounds. So think how much damage he could have done. Luckily, you know, this is a guy, you remember, too. He did all this damage and then killed himself.
Well, yeah, because of the gun jam.
Yeah, but
that's why he killed himself.
Going, you know, how much he could have taken that whole school out. I mean, this is unbelievable. But, again, it would not be possible if there was any kind of sensible regulation.
Now, they have, well, hey, we're even going to get worse than that. There are, and I know you don't believe this, there are senators who don't even want background checks.
How could you not want a background check?
I'm going to give you their names. Jeff Flake, Republican, Arizona.
Total Flake.
Saxby Chambliss, Republican, Georgia. Johnny Isakson, Republican, Georgia. Dan Coats, Republican, Indiana. Charles Grassley, Republican, Iowa.
Well, Charles.
Susan
right.
Collins, Maine, Republican.
Maine.
Kelly Ayotte, Republican, New Hampshire. Dean Miller, Republican, New York. Bob Portman, Republican, Ohio. Pat Toomey, Republican, Pennsylvania. Mark Pryor, Democrat.
Excuse me?
Arkansas.
I'm sorry, there was a difference in that one. Can
yes.
you read that again?
Mark Pryor, Democrat, Arkansas.
Hey, Mark.
John
worry.
Donnelly, Democrat, Indiana. Joe Donnelly, you should say. Mary Landrieu, Democrat, Louisiana. Kay Hagan, Democrat. But I understand today
I thought she,
said that she is changing her mind.
That's right.
So
thank
give
thank
Kay
you.
Hagan from our state of North Carolina a round of applause.
Way to go, Kay.
Heidi Hillicamp, North Dakota. So we have 4 Democrats and 10 Republicans who are against background checks.
So basically anybody, you can be insane, you can be a felon,
absolutely.
It doesn't matter. You get a gun no matter what, because if you got money, you're good enough to go. Now, what kind of sense is that? How does it affect anybody to have a background check to make sure you're not criminal,
well,
insane, or just a criminal?
Well, playing the devil's advocate here. Playing the devil's advocate. I don't want a background check because you're going to come and get my gun. Is that reasonable?
What kind of black helicopter crap is that, Mike?
I see him out there at night. I look out the window, and but seeing the trees, you can't see him in the summertime. You can only see him in the wintertime when there's no leaves on the trees. They're out there hiding.
This is like the people you ever see. You're going to a grocery store and Target or something like this, and you got that person in front of you that's going, well, I don't want to give you my phone number. You're going to track me down. Yeah, it's too late. I hate to tell you.
Yeah, well.
Okay? You remember a couple of years ago there was a scandal here in North Carolina because, gasp, they found out that it's not just your phone company and your cable company and your bank and your McDonald's and your ATM and everybody else that's spying on you and reporting all your data and selling all your data to every other company that
you
they know.
You mentioned Dick Cheney.
Okay, well, they found out the police, your local and your state police, take your information. You know when you get a thing called a driver's license, all that kind of stuff?
Oh, yes.
Well, to help fund themselves because of the complete collapse of our system where we don't pay people like firemen and policemen and everything else so that we can keep propping up the banks in America. They raise money by selling all the data of the citizens.
Are you kidding me?
So you remember that big news story came out a few years ago when people gasped, found out that all their private data had been sold, not by any nefarious, you know, Walmart employee, but by the state and local police departments. They sold it en masse, all the data, so they could make money, so they could continue to do little things like police. So it's already too late. If you think that you have any modicum of anonymity in this society, when every time you have ever made a phone call or logged onto a computer or done anything else now, they track and record every single thing you ever do. You know, and now, just to make it worse for all you black helicopter conspirators, you know, they're already testing the technology. They've already got it, and they're putting it in everywhere. But now they have facial recognition technology. And they've had that for years, but now, you know, they're doing it in the malls. Have you seen this, what they're doing in the department stores, in the malls? And what they do is they're tracking and advertising and consumer companies are collating all this data, and they sell your shopping habits and your itinerary to companies so that they know, like every time you go to a mall, you go to the IMAX store, into the so-and-so jewelry store, into the so-and-so clothing shop, and that's your habits. So then they'll start targeting you with only those brands that you frequent. So they don't waste time because they know you never go down to the corn dog hut or whatever. That's already happening.
Yes.
It's already done.
Yes.
So why are we even having this arcane debate that if you somehow register a weapon, evil, all-knowing government is going to know you've got a weapon? What?
Well, Dick Cheney is the one that first started this program of invasion, and we're going to talk about that when we talk about Dick Cheney, because that's part of that Showtime special documentary. And that was the problem where he had faced half of the lawyers in the U.S. corporate lawyers resigning if he didn't take the language out where he was could listen to everybody. And he said, well, I don't understand why they don't want to do it. It's been reauthorized 26 times. Yeah, because your people were in the Attorney General. But when they got legitimate people, even though they were conservatives, they said, hell no, this is illegal, and we're not going to do it. We're all going to resign. And then it was going to go, they talked to the who was the FBI director. He said, I'm going to resign too.
Yep.
So, you know. But
that's because of Echelon and all that Patriot Act and all that stuff. But
before we get away, I got a gentleman on the phone here that I want who just come out of a meeting, and he is going to tell us. Matt Newton, how are you?
Yes, sir. It's great to be here, Michael. I'm great. How are you doing?
I am doing fine. Matt, tell us, where'd you just come from?
I came from a meeting of the League of Women Voters, promoting a meeting on Monday night. We are working in a concert with the NAACP, the Charlotte School of Law, as well as the African American Caucus, Democracy North Carolina, Action Agency, to raise the Citizens Review Board issue with city council on Monday.
Uh-huh. And what is the issue that you're hot on the trail of?
Well, this is a community building effort. And what we would like to do is we would like to work in conjunction with Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department as well as city council to strengthen the Citizens Review Board, give them the power to do what they are there to do in the first place.
Mm-hmm. And had there been any sort of reason why this has now come up again? I know quite a few years back it was a problem. What has happened in the meantime that they got the number one lawyer in Charlotte on the case?
it came to my attention with a Charlotte Observer article. And the issue here is that the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department has no independent oversight. The arbiter of last resort for many citizens is the Citizens Review Board. And unfortunately, the review board doesn't have any teeth. The article, it was an expose. And the article, it expressed the fact that in the past 16 years, and this review board was established in 1997, over its entire 16-year existence, it's never once sided with a citizen. The official count right now is 0 for 78.
Jeez. not once sided with
not
a citizen?
Not once. Not once. We aren't pointing fingers, and I want to make that clear. I had an interview with Channel 9 News this morning, and we'll be doing interviews with hopefully Fox Charlotte as well as Channel 14 News over the next couple of days. But I want to make perfectly clear that we aren't pointing fingers. We're not saying that it's the police department, city council, or for that matter, the board itself. The issue is the ordinance that gives the board power to act in the first place. It's grossly inadequate, and it doesn't give the board power more than an advisory role. So it doesn't give them, like I was saying before, teeth. There's an issue of transparency as well, and we feel as though there needs to be an ombudsman or some sort of representation for the citizen as they navigate their way through the process.
Well, who would how would the ombudsman work? I've seen they've had plenty of those in New York City where I'm from, but how would it work down here?
Well, we would like to see someone with some expertise or someone who's familiar with the process. Unfortunately, we know that the police department and police attorneys have been in front of the board 78 times. Every time a citizen goes in front of the board, it's their first time. Now, there is a provision within the ordinance right now that allows the Community Relations Committee to assist the citizen in filing an appeal to the board. I can comment as well on the actual process itself because that might be a little confusing. But they can help with the filing of the complaint or the appeal to the board, but that's where their role ends. And I think that part of the issue here is giving the citizen the same footing as the police department in these hearings. And that's lacking because from that point forward, and granted the community relations committee itself doesn't necessarily have to have anyone with expertise in this particular area, but hopefully they do. And if they don't, then this would be a way to even solve the issue that much further. The fact that there could be an individual, whether it be someone who is working in another capacity as well, but someone who certainly has some experience and expertise, and not just the filing, but then taking this forward, helping someone prepare their case for the board, and then actually prepare someone for what they should expect in the hearing itself.
Okay, but so how does this work now? I mean, in what capacity would a civilian complain to the review board?
Well, to take you through the process, it starts with a citizen filing a complaint with the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department. At that point, the department's internal affairs unit will review the complaint. They make a recommendation to the police chief after reviewing the complaint. If they don't dismiss it, they make a recommendation as to whether or not there should be discipline for the particular officer that's cited in the complaint. At that point, depending upon the dismissal or the discipline, the citizen has the opportunity to appeal whatever that decision is to the Citizens Review Board. Unfortunately, and I think part of the problem in the entire process is the fact that the Citizens Review Board doesn't have to hear the appeal in the first place. But assuming they do, then their standard of review is unspeakably high. There is no independent investigatory power for them to subpoena or to conduct any sort of other independent investigation that they would like to do. And let's face it, there's also no power for them to overturn a decision of the police or mandate their own decision.
So a question for you about that, because it seems to put, and maybe this is exactly what you are addressing, but it seems to put a huge burden on the citizen that you have to, you've been aggrieved, you have to go to the police, you have to go through two or three layers of the police saying that you are essentially correct to even get to the point where you can get it to the board to review it. And then everything yet again is on you with no help. Is that just what I'm reading here?
It's horribly ineffective at best. And okay. I think in its current form, functions as a red herring. We won't say that this is the fox watching the hen house, but what I will say is that due process and fairness, our basic system of checks and balances and inherent within our government, would suggest that this is on, this needs to be changed. And it certainly is something that has led to an enormous amount of erosion in the public trust in our police department and within our city government. And so I think that it's certainly something that we should all be able to come together, create a consensus for, and hopefully have meaningful change on. It starts with the rewriting of the ordinance, and we're calling for a turnout in mass of people who are concerned with this issue on Monday night, because what will happen is we have been told that one of the council members will be referring this issue to committee. And the problem there is that once in committee, the public no longer has a voice.
Right.
The committee members, including the chief of police, can speak incessantly about the issue and make their own decisions. But our last opportunity will be Monday night. We have a slate of speakers at the Citizens Forum to speak on behalf of the people. We just need to have a good turnout in support of us speakers, so the city council knows that this is an issue to take seriously, and the committee knows that this issue to take seriously.
Okay, so it's just not, again, ignored and swept under the carpet. Just a press.
We don't want a Band-Aid here. We want meaningful change. We want a board that has the power to make an independent decision separate from the police department. And also, I think you make an excellent point. Also, we would like to see fairness for the citizens.
Right. So is this like kind of like the problem with the banks when everything was deregulated, that we can have an actual viable opportunity for citizens that.
Hello?
Hello, I missed that last part. It cut out on me there. I think what this is
go ahead.
Hello? I think this is an instance where it can be a win-win for us all. You know, we can strengthen the public trust, and in so doing, the public trust in our institutions within the city, and in so doing, also ensure that the institutions themselves are stronger. We all come out of this better for it. And that's why I think it's so direly important that the issue be taken seriously and that the ordinance actually effectuate change that allows everyone to play on the same level playing field.
Okay. Hey, well, Mr. Newton, do our fellow citizens a favor. Tell us what time, where, and
yes, sir. Yes, sir. I'm sorry. Sorry about that.
No, that's no problem. Let us know. Get there.
We're asking that everyone please show up by 6:45 at the Government Center downtown. It's I believe it's 600 Trade Street, and we will be meeting in the atrium. We expect there to be a media presence, and so that's why it's imperative that we have as many people as possible. Because we would like for this to be something that can't be ignored by the committee members. At that point, at 7:30 is when we will actually be speaking, or soon thereafter. Please, we're asking everyone to please wear black as well, just as a show of solidarity so everyone knows who we are.
Okay. And is there anyone that we can contact? Is it you or the forum? Or who do we contact? Who's the point person? And where's a website, a phone number, or something that people can get in touch and get involved?
Yes, sir. I would say please go to our Facebook page. That is the name of the Facebook page is CRB, which stands for Citizens Review Board, CRB Report Now. If you go there, then you can find more information. It's simplistic right now. The way that the Facebook page is it's set up, we're asking for likes on that page. But there's information now. There's a link to the Charlotte Observer article. There's information pertaining to the date and time of the meeting. We will be posting information pertaining to the committee meeting when that becomes available. And there's also an opportunity for any questions. You can post your questions on that particular site. We also have a group page, CRB Reform Now, as well, where you can commit to showing up if you like.
Who on the city council is going to be there?
At this point, we're hoping for it is a Easter holiday, so we're hoping that as many city council members can be present as possible. We're hoping that Patrick Cannon is there, that Michael Barnes is, Claire Fallon, Beth Pickering, the mayor. We were encouraged by the fact that the mayor has come out and asked for a review or an audit of sorts of the Citizens Review Board. That evening, actually before 7:30, the police department will be given a presentation as well on what the Citizens Review Board is and how it operates. So that should be before 7:30. We aren't completely sure at this point when that will be. I will be there for that as well, and it's also open to the general public.
All right, Matthew, I want to thank you for taking your time out, and maybe next week you can come back on and tell us how everything went.
I will be happy to. Thank you so much for having me, Michael. You're the best.
No, okay. You're doing quite good yourself. Thank you.
Keep up the good work.
Thank you. Thank you.
This was Matthew Newton, who is taking it to... I hope to the city council, because these guys need to be.
Well, you know what? Standing up for the little guys. Standing
Absolutely.
Up for the common man. You know, citizens, and this is the thing we've said 1,000 times on here, apathy is a killer. Get involved. Don't let monolithic organizations, no matter who they are, not just saying the police department
right.
or their city council, or any organization, government at large, don't be scared of it. It's your government.
That's right.
Stand up, take power back, do something, stand up.
And they have Matthew standing up for you, so you're on the right track. Okay, let's go to the funnies. It's a new piece of our show here. Let's go to the funnies.
Because we have to lighten the mood after all this.
After all this, we've got to lighten the mood.
That dick that was in the air.
Sure. Yeah.
Oh, God, there's so much controversy.
That's it.
That is a nice, happy story. We had a recent Powerball lottery, a jackpot winner. A man from Passaic, New Jersey, won $330 million, and congratulations to that man and his family. Seems like a nice guy, and the kids seem wonderful. Listen to this. The odds of winning that thing, 175 million to one. Yep, it's just about the same odds the Republicans have for getting the White House back in 2016. Just about the same. Now, it's probably happened to you. You've been hacked on your computer. You have hackers come in and get you. They, it's all the Chinese. That's what they do in their free time. They hack. It happened to George W. Bush. Now, listen to this. This is fascinating for a couple of reasons. But my point is, it happened to former President George W. Bush. And if it can happen to the former president, it can happen to anybody. And it turns out, here's the other part I didn't realize. He is an artist. He's an amateur artist as a hobby. He paints dogs. He has a large collection of dog paintings. And the hacker broke into his computer, stole all the dog paintings. Yeah. Stole all the dog paintings. So... think about this. One day, you're president of the United States.
And the next day, you're in the basement painting a schnauzer. Now think about that. One day. That's it, Abby. 10th anniversary of the Iraqi War. Oh, my God. You know Dick Cheney? Yeah. Anybody know Dick Cheney? Always the horn section.
Well, it's a small world.
It is a small world. Well, Dick Cheney's the one who got us into the Iraqi War. They said they had weapons of mass destruction. They had no weapons of mass destruction. And even if they had weapons of mass destruction, they'd have to launch them from a donkey. So,
nonetheless,
that's right. They're saying to Dick Cheney, well, what about the Iraqi War? And Dick Cheney said, look, even if I had a conscience, the Iraqi War would not be on my conscience. That's what he said. And right now, the new Secretary of State, John Kerry, what do you think? Is he getting it done? Yeah, only a couple of weeks in, and I don't know. It's hard to trust a guy who's not wearing a pantsuit.
Get used to something.
Cognitive dissonance. Let's turn to the Republican Party's new rising star, Dr. Ben Carson.
Marriage is between a man and a woman.
No group,
be they gays, be they NAMLA, be they people who believe in bestiality, it doesn't matter what they are.
Yeah, let me just stop you right there. It's not, you know, whether you're having sex with another consenting adult or a horse or a donut, it's all the same. Actually, that's not fair. As Dr. Carson explained, his problem isn't with gay people.
It's not something that's against gays. It's against anybody who wants to come along and change the fundamental definitions of pillars of society.
Oh, you think we shouldn't mess with anything that's considered a fundamental pillar of society? Ah, I yield for an editorial cartoon. All right, here we go. I'm going to do this over here. Black neurosurgeon who proudly stand in front of a medical school. The road to that school is littered with broken pillar parts labeled slavery, segregation, and Jim Crow, and there's a gay, sad-looking couple standing nearby, an intact pillar that says traditional marriage, and they've got a little thought bubble that's coming out that says little help. And here, let me show you. That's just, I drew, this is, it's, anyway, that's my idea for the editorial cartoon. This is just a penis cannon shooting an airplane because that's all I really know how to draw. We'll be right back.
Yes, yes, yes. That's the funny. We had to go out on a, but you know what we were talking about? The news.
To lighten the mood a little.
Yeah, well, you talk about the news with Joe Galloway and great news reporter.
We know it's heavy subject.
I have to play my opening scene from Newsroom.
Of course, of course.
I mean, this, you know, you have to hear this if you haven't heard it before.
If you've heard this, you've heard it before.
Mm-hmm.
The New York Jets. No, I'm going to hold you to an answer on that. What makes America the greatest country in the world? Well, Lewis and Sharon said it, diversity and opportunity and freedom. I'm not letting you go back to the airport without answering the question. Well, our Constitution is a masterpiece. James Madison was a genius. The Declaration of Independence is, for me, the single greatest piece of American writing.
You don't look satisfied.
One's a set of laws and the other's a declaration of war. I want a human moment from you.
What about the people? Why is America
not the greatest country in the world, Professor? That's my answer.
You're saying
yes.
Let's talk about...
Fine. Sharon, the NEA is a loser. Yeah, it accounts for a penny out of her paycheck, but he gets to hit you with it any time he wants. It doesn't cost money. It costs votes. It costs airtime and column inches. You know why people don't like liberals? Because they lose. If liberals are so fucking smart, how come they lose so goddamn always?
Hey.
And with a straight face, you're going to tell students that America is so star-spangled awesome that we're the only ones in the world who have freedom? Canada has freedom. Japan has freedom. The UK, France, Italy, Germany, Spain, Australia, Belgium has freedom. So 207 sovereign states in the world, like 180 of them have freedom.
All right.
And yeah, you, sorority girl, just in case you accidentally wander into a voting booth one day, there's some things you should know. And one of them is there is absolutely no evidence to support the statement that we're the greatest country in the world. We're 7th in literacy, 27th in math, 22nd in science, 49th in life expectancy, 178th in infant mortality, 3rd in median household income, number 4 in labor force, and number 4 in exports. We lead the world in only three categories: number of incarcerated citizens per capita, number of adults who believe angels are real, and defense spending, where we spend more than the next 26 countries combined, 25 of whom are allies. Now, none of this is the fault of a 20-year-old college student, but you nonetheless are, without a doubt, a member of the worst period, generation, period, ever, period. So when you ask what makes us the greatest country in the world, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about. Yosemite? Sure used to be. We stood up for what was right. We fought for moral reasons. We passed laws, struck down laws for moral reasons. We waged wars on poverty, not poor people. We sacrificed. We cared about our neighbors. We put our money where our mouths were, and we never beat our chest. We built great big things, made ungodly technological advances, explored the universe, cured diseases, and we cultivated the world's greatest artists and the world's greatest economy. We reached for the stars, acted like men. We aspired to intelligence. We didn't belittle it. It didn't make us feel inferior. We didn't identify ourselves by who we voted for in the last election, and we didn't scare so easy. We were able to be all these things and do all these things because we were informed by great men, men who were revered. First step in solving any problem is recognizing there is one. America is not the greatest country in the world anymore. Enough?
Yes, is that enough? Well, it's enough.
It's not true.
It's the truth. And it was fitting to hear this from when we were speaking to Joe Galloway today. And, well, this is Good Friday, and we got to go. I got two engagements I got to do on Saturday, and what are you going to do?
Next week I'm actually going down to Mississippi, taking a trip back to the third world there. Going to check it out. But no, it's for a good cause. We're going down for a wedding, so it's a good thing.
Somebody is
one of those different relevant things. But anyway, so here's the thing: I want to urge people
bring
to
bring gator meat or what?
I want to urge people to say, you know, we talked to Joe Galloway today. He was exceptional. I really, really, really am honored to have him on here. I'm impressed by his knowledge. Mm-hmm. And I urge people to think about the things he talked about and to look into it. You know, look him up. You can look him up on Wikipedia. And you can see some of the things he's done and talked about, reported on. And do some investigating yourself. Don't be ignorant.
Don't be
aware of the
world. Of course, that doesn't. We're not talking to you people who listen to Fox News. But
the thinkers.
Yes. I'm going to be having an egg hunt here this Sunday.
That's right.
I'm also going to roast a lamb.
You know the funny thing
Not
I saw online?
Not the whole lamb, just the leg.
The funny thing I saw online, I'll tell you real quick.
What's that?
It was a bunny laying flat on its back.
with a cracked open egg and on it, you know, like from Alien. Funniest thing I saw online this week, Mike.
Oh, God. All right. This has been The Last Word. Michael Lawson and Thomas Fortenberry.
Happy
live
Easter.
From Charlotte, North Carolina. Wish everybody a very happy Easter. Yeah.